The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the 8th episode of Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Thanks again for everyone that's been listening. Had a lot of good feedback. Going to try to keep it going. So the podcast today, and I can only talk for a couple minutes because the interview goes a little long. Of course, a lot of the interviews have been going long. I apologize. It's with Tom Eddy. And Tom Eddy is the absolute king when it comes to Napa Cab. And I shouldn't say the only king. There's lots of kings. There's lots of great Napa Cabernet Sauvignon. He's one of my favorites. He's a little bit smaller, doesn't make as much wine, maybe a little bit more unknown. So great interview with him, fascinating guy. And I'm glad that I can introduce him to new people because he makes Napa Cab the right way, where just that balance between power and delicacy. And it's very difficult to do, and you don't always succeed. And more often than not, he does. Some great stories, harrowing tales about how the fires of 2017 in the Napa-Sonoma area, just how much devastation it did to his vineyards. But thankfully, no one was hurt. And I was thinking I wanted to give one little quick tip. And that is, especially when you go into expensive restaurants, do corkage. And for people who don't know, and I'm assuming most people do, corkage is just when you bring your own wine to the restaurant. And most restaurants will allow corkage, but check, call and ask. There are websites out there, some really good websites, no matter what city you're in, where they'll list all the restaurants that have corkage. They'll tell you what nights of the week they allow it. Some nights they charge more, some nights they charge less, usually more on a Friday or Saturday, less earlier in the week. But I would definitely recommend call to make sure because restaurants change their policies all the time about it. And one of my big messages is don't feel shame about it. Don't feel, oh, I don't want to be cheap. Because some restaurants, the markup is crazy. I remember, and I'm not going to give the name away, a famous steak joint where wine that we would sell to them, the retail price was probably $13-14. They charge $75. That's ridiculous. That's way too much. So bring your own bottle. It's a great way to save money. And what I often do is I'll bring the bottle, tell them to decant it, and then we'll order a glass or two of white wine because, you know, we want to make sure that everyone is compensated. And wine is a great source of revenue. And I have a weird guilt complex. I want to make sure our servers, especially if they're good, you know, you want to make sure they're compensated. Also, a good bottle will often be treated like a celebrity in a nice place. I remember going to the Drake Hotel in Prince Edward County, brought a 20-plus-year-old bottle of a really good, you know, high-end. It was a high-end Bordeaux. It was a birthday dinner for me. My girlfriend and I went out, and they were, you know, they were almost as excited about the wine as I was to drink it. And they were just, you know, they were excited just to see the bottle. They thought it was cool. And I love that sort of respect in the wine world. I mean, they're not even going to get to gulp down that delicious, delicious wine, but they were still excited nonetheless. So, you know, I appreciated that. And yeah, I brought a bottle, an old bottle of Tom Eddy to Jacobs, which is a really good steak joint in Toronto. And their wine prices are high. That restaurant's incredible, but they're great. They were great about the wine. I brought it there a couple hours early, and I told them, could you decant this 90 minutes? And this one, I said, just take the cork out right away. And they were fantastic. So go and do it. I think my favorite or funniest story I heard about it was at one place where it was a canoe, high-end restaurant in downtown Toronto, top of the TD Tower. One group of people brought a magnum of Yellowtail for corkage. And the somm didn't even charge him. He was laughing. He thought it was funny. And he wasn't laughing in some sort of condescending way. It's just not something you normally see. So, I mean, do it. Bring the bottle, especially if it's something nice you've been waiting on, because it's a great way to marry with a really good meal. Usually $20 to $30 is what you'll get charged. I've seen it as much as $50. And if it's $50, it better be at a damn good restaurant. And if it's $50, you bring your best bottle. You know, my rule is the bottle I'm bringing better be, you know, whatever it is on the menu price, it better be 7-8 times as expensive if I'm going to be paying $30 to $50. So yeah, corkage. It is a great wine, great way to enjoy your favorite wines while you get to enjoy a great meal and save a little bit of money. Anyway, thanks again for listening. Again, you can catch the podcast, Audio Boom, iTunes, Stitcher. Tell your friends. Got a lot of good stuff coming up. Going to be doing a trip to Prince Edward County. A lot of other interesting interviews in the next couple of weeks for you. And without further ado, Tom Eddy. He's not going to admit it, or maybe he will. Actually, it'd be great if he did. We're with a wine celebrity. Legit, no joke, one of the best in terms of Napa Cabernet. He's been making wine for around 40 years. He's been in Napa and Northern California since he was a kid. It is Tom Eddy. Tom, thank you so much for doing this.
Well, I'm excited to be in Toronto again. It's great.
Yeah, well, you come around here every now and then. You work with Barrel Select, one of my favorite wine consignment companies, and you've had a relationship with them for ages. Yeah, this is great to have you here.
Yeah, no, it's fun. No, I was around for the first supplier, I think, for Don and Jeff 17, 18 years ago.
Really?
Yeah. No, it was, I took a chance, came to Canada.
Yeah.
But, they put together a solid program and it's fun now because I love coming back to Toronto, seeing all my old restaurant buddies.
Yeah.
It's like home week. I just love Toronto.
Well, and when this airs, the event will have happened, but we're going to be at a wine event tonight at the National Club. And I can tell you, your event sold out ages ago. And the National Club, they do a bunch of wine events every year. They have Mission Hill coming up. They had Calera just a little while ago, a good Pinot producer. But your event, there's a sign up at the National Club for it and it just says sold out. So you've been sold out for a little while.
Great.
I'm curious. Just go back. I remember reading about you moved to Northern California when you were 11. And one of your quotes, I'm so old that people don't even remember the wineries I used to work for. What were your impressions of Northern California just as a teenager and as you were going to UC Davis?
Well, you know, I guess I have to step back a couple of weeks and say, you know, why we did go to California, Northern California, was to basically get out of the L.A. scene, traffic, crime, smog, whatever.
Yeah.
It was a coincidence, really, that my father was transferred to the little town of Davis, where the university is, that offers the wine program. So when I was 14, I was just exposed to all these professors socially with parents. And loved wine, loved food at that time, thought maybe one day I'll be a chef. You know, I didn't know when I was 14, but I read about wine, and my folks drank some wine, but we didn't have Google in those days, you know, so I had...
A couple of years before.
I had to go to the library to read about wine.
Microfish, Dewey Decimal System, all that stuff.
Yeah. Slide rules.
Hey, when I went to university, I was there right before the internet took off, so I have some idea.
Okay, yeah. I understand. Well, I got hooked on wine, and my folks encouraged me to experiment. I made wine at home. I made beer at home in high school. I was very popular in high school.
You made beer in high school?
Yes.
You would have been the most popular guy. Usually it's get someone with fake ID to buy his beer and you're making it.
Well, we had a rule in the house. You know, my friends could come over every other Friday night.
Yeah.
And we would open up several bottles under my parents' supervision, and then they couldn't leave unless they were, you know, breath tested by my parents.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was fun, and I was so excited about fermentation and started doing dinners for my parents because I like to cook anyway. And that was leverage to get my dad to let me buy, through him, of course, a couple bottles at the liquor store on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
So I would buy a bottle. Let's say it's a $4.99 Beaujolais Village.
Yeah.
Take it home. Didn't know anything about it. Knew it was reasonably priced for a French wine. And then go to the library, read about it, taste it, call people. I had the audacity in those days to call professors when I was 15 years old that I'd met
at
cocktail parties and say, "What'd you think about this wine?" And of course, they'd say, "That's nuts." You know, I mean, they were polite to me, but they said, "Listen, you'll learn about that. You just need to come to Davis. You need to get into the program." So I was excited, and I did. I applied to UC Davis, and that was the only school.
That's what a fantastic story, just getting a head start on so many people. Usually people fall into wine often a little bit later, mid-20s. Mm-hmm. But for you, it was so much younger, and I guess a lot of it just you were a product of your geography, just, and also
right.
of having parents that were pretty open-minded. Could you imagine in 2018, you know, parents are much more overprotective, allowing the same sort of thing that your parents, you know, did, which was very reasonable every other Friday and under their house. But yeah, I guess a lot of it, you were just a product of your geography and your family.
No, that's a good way to put it, Matt. Product yeah. of geography.
Yeah. So, and see, it's funny. One of the questions I had here was, did you ever want to do anything else? But after being a cook, we can yeah. we can move on from that. We're also going to be trying four of your wines. And I was just wondering, because I was thinking we'll go back and forth, ask you questions, but then yeah. also try one of your wines. And I'd love for you to tell the listeners
sure.
your own thoughts about what we're tasting, if that's all right.
Well, that's works out great.
Perfect. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you another question as you're answering.
Okay.
I'll pour. And the first one is your Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, a Sauvignon Blanc is a fun product. I'd made a lot of Sauvignon Blancs up and down the state over the years. Napa, Sonoma, Mendocino, Monterey County. Never really been really excited about the wines. But I love New Zealand. I love the character of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc with the grapefruit and the acid and so forth. So one day when my wife and I got into a big argument about the decision to buy wine at the grocery store.
Yeah.
I said, how could you do this to me? How could you spend $4 on this crappy wine that I can't even drink on a hot summer day?
Yeah.
And she said, well, why don't you do something about it? I said, I will. We're going to go to New Zealand. We're going to make wine in New Zealand. And I called up Kim Crawford, who I'd met
yeah.
earlier in the year. And I said, Kim, throw me a couple names. I'm just going to go. We're just going to hang out in the vineyard for 3 weeks, meet some people, and see what happens. And sure enough, I met all these wonderful Kiwis and discovered these wonderful Sauvignon Blanc vineyards in Cloudy Bay area in Marlborough.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. I said, I want to buy these grapes, set up a program, and boom, that was 14 years ago, Matt. So now this is our 14th year making the wine, and it's a very unusual, very different type of Sauvignon Blanc approach. We, first of all, a lot of the Kiwis pick very early compared to California,
mm-hmm.
and the acids can be quite high.
Yeah.
And they don't worry about it too much because a lot of them add sugar, which is, oh, no, here, we don't do that. But I said, why don't you pick the grapes a little bit later? So we get more viscosity, we get more complexity, we get more fruit, we get less acid, and we have, I think, a better balanced wine. So I'm the bad guy when I come every year to New Zealand in the harvest.
You're evil American. You're evil
God.
American just stamping your manifest destiny on the grapes.
Saying, okay, we're not going to pick yet. What? Come on, the machines are running, Tom, let's go. I'm always the last guy to pick.
Really?
But the result is that we have, I think, a better balanced wine. You know, you get the, especially in the middle mouth when you're, I have to take a sip here. It's not as acidulous as some inexpensive New Zealand.
It doesn't have the New Zealand, the same New Zealand attack. Like I find, that's, you know, certainly I could use a better term. But what I find is a lot of the more inexpensive or just factory-made New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, you can smell it a mile away. On any blind wine tasting, you thank the gods if they pour one because you know what it is. But then the middle part, it gets really it's a really aggressive fruit punch coming at you.
Yeah, it can be a little bit over the top. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And we also do, we also stir the lees mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an added layer of creaminess, you know, in the wine. And that's kind of why we want a wine that's balanced, that it's also a restaurant wine too, not just, it's not so much a collector's wine, it is a restaurant wine, it's a food wine. And, we've been doing it the same way. We do change the vineyards a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
If I find a new young grower that I think's got his act together and I love what he's doing, I love the fruit, you know, I'll nibble around here and see if I can get a few tons.
But do people know when you're coming? Sorry to interrupt you. Do growers in New Zealand know that Eddie's around and maybe is snooping? It's almost like you're in sports. It's almost like you're a scout checking out a new shortstop.
Well, maybe some people may view it that way. Maybe I'm a little the horse fly on the back of the horse, perhaps.
Yeah.
But because we're so small, we're only producing about 1,000 cases. But it's a lot. It's a fun project. Of course, now we're so integrated into the system that we can work in the harvest for a week and then run around New Zealand for another week and play a little bit. So
it's great. I was there 2 years ago, and I just did the North Island. Spent a lot of time Gimmick Gravels, Waiheke Island.
Mm-hmm.
I knew about the Syrah. I was shocked with the quality of the Bordeaux blends, especially Waiheke Island. I tried some really age-worthy Bordeaux and Merlot Cab Franc blends that were fantastic. I was curious if you could just if you were given a tasting note for your 10s, Sauvignon yep. Blanc, what year is this?
This should be the 17.
17?
Yeah. Yeah, it's... So you open up with a little bit of tropical, a little bit of grapefruit, a little bit of kiwi, but you don't... It's not over the top. It's all well balanced. And then you get a nice round fruit in the middle as you swirl it around. And the finish is very pleasant. There's just enough acid to make it a crisp, but not irritating, not irritatingly. Mm-hmm. And it's very refreshing. I recommend California sunshine, 85 degrees, and a shaded deck.
Yeah.
That's what I recommend.
And yeah, I do like it. Just the acidity, it's all there, and it connects it all, but it's not as bracing as some of the New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs. And some people, that's their style. I find a lot of the Marlboro, it's a little bit too aggressive for me. Some of the Cloudy Bay ones, I enjoy more. But I've drank that 10s for a bunch of years. I'm always excited when the National Club throws some of it, especially by the glass.
Yeah.
Every now and then, when they get the by the glass 10s, Sauvignon Blanc's fantastic. All right, so we're going to bounce back and forth. This will be one of the more hardcore, nerdy wine questions because I try to do a balance. I want to learn more about you and your journey, but also, I mean, you're here. So what for you are the biggest difference? Because you talk a lot about this. Where your grapes are sourced from in California, it's mountain grapes.
Right.
And for people who don't know, because you hear about mountain or more just flatter valley floor style, what are the biggest differences between the two, in your opinion?
Yeah. I think first of all, there's a huge difference with Cabernet because it likes to grow in the mountains. Why does it like to grow in the mountains? Why does it make a better wine? First of all, the soils are different. You have the valley floor, Napa Valley, is geologically material that's broken down over the years and eroded from the mountains down to the floor. And it's very heavy clay, some clay, some loam, deep soils, rich soils with a lot of water. Up on the mountains, on the eroded mountains, you have thinner soils. Cabernet likes thinner soils. They like the minerals. They don't like a lot of nitrogen. The emphasis for Cabernet when you have thinner soils goes right to the fruit, not necessarily to the green growth of the plant. And as a result, you get more concentration. Now, some varieties like, let's say, Chardonnay, Merlot, they can deal with the heavier soils.
Yeah.
Cabernet likes the thinner soils in the mountains. So you have the thinner mineral soils focus on the fruit intensity. And then you have the elevation. So with the elevation, you're getting cooler temperatures at night primarily. And that is the secret for balance, structure, and tannin and color, is the cooler nights when the plant doesn't have to work so hard, doesn't respire away all its acid. So when you have that, you're going to make bigger, bolder, structured, ageable Cabernets versus stuff grown in heavier soil. And then the other thing is you have the radiation is different in the mountain.
Really?
You don't have a lot of the fog along the river that burns, say it burns off at 10 o'clock, that's fine.
Yeah.
But you still have radiation. You get some bright sunshine, and that's what you need to get full ripeness. So you got full ripeness, but then, oh, here comes the break. When the sun goes down over the hill, it's colder up there. So the vine doesn't respire away the acid, and you produce wines that have ageability and structure. You see that without getting technical, you see that in the lab a little bit, but you also sense it, you also feel it when you're up there. It's amazing.
In one of the interviews I read of yours, when you talked about your Cabernet, you said, I want a wine that's big and powerful and structured, yet elegant. Yeah. That seems to me the hardest thing to do, because you can go around and get big and powerful, but sometimes at the expense of just that sort of aromatic and the elegance on the palate. I would imagine that's the most difficult thing for you to do for your cabs.
Yeah. So in a way, you're leading me on to explain an oxymoron, perhaps. But
yeah.
In fact, this is a key. The two things we do to make the wine big, structured, and yet elegant. One is we don't use the press wine. The press wine is sold to someone else, and so you don't have the bitter tannins.
Yeah, okay.
Okay,
yeah,
so yeah. Huh. Number two is that we're leaving the wine in French oak longer than almost all of that Napa Valley wineries, so a minimum of 3 years. When that happens, the tannins, the rougher tannins, often integrate with the wood, and you have a wine that has the structure, but the tannins are more polished, and yet you haven't pumped it around. A lot of winemakers tend to move the wine too much and aerate it, but we only move the wine once in 3 years.
Really?
So the wine is all packaged up and gives it ageability. So sure, you can buy our wines upon release after 5 years and enjoy them tomorrow, but you can also feel comfortable that you can age the wine for 15 or 20 years. Under normal storage conditions, the wines will be just really bright and solid after that long time. And that's what I'm kind of aiming toward.
And clearly then, you know, it's more about and how difficult it is. It's more about quality than it is a profit, because the wine is sitting there longer. Your profit is sitting there, you know, aging, you know, in storage at your vineyard. Have you ever felt pressure to release it sooner because you need the infusion of capital?
Well, there's always that pressure, I have to say. But
it's 5 years. It's like Rioja. Yeah.
There's been big time pressure, especially from the bank, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, but doing this for 27 years, you get into, with just the Tom Eddy Cab, 27 vintages, you get into a role, you know, and you realize it's going to be hard right now, but it's going to be good next year.
Yeah.
And that's what I've always told the bankers. And they said, well, why can't you follow the Mondavi model or the Camus model? I said, well, we're not going to do that, because we're going to compromise quality. It's not what we set out to do. The first 2 years, Matt, were the toughest.
Oh, yeah.
We had no money.
You had no money coming in. You're like, okay, let me the vineyard and the vines and that and the crushing and the pressing and the human labor and the cost there.
it was unbelievable early on. But now we've kind of settled into a routine, and I don't want to change. You know, during that 27 years, the cycle has actually changed. People's approach to stylistic winemaking has swung 180 degrees.
Oh, yeah.
Really interesting. Really interesting.
Well, because it was, you know, it was somewhere in the 90s or 2000s. Big, big, big. Robert Parker, big. And then people got angry at it, and then it starts to sway the other way, which I want to get into. I got 100 questions with you. But let's talk about, I want to circle back to this.
Okay.
Let's talk about the Chardonnay, the story behind it. Because Chardonnay is, I don't want to say new, but in comparison to some of your other ventures, it's a little bit more relatively new for you.
We felt a need to have three labels,
mm-hmm.
Actually four. Many people, including my wife, was banging me pretty hard to produce Chardonnay. She loves Chardonnay.
Yeah.
And so over the years, we made one or two Chardonnays. I don't want to be just another guy Chardonnay, you know? So the thought was that we would first produce Chardonnay under a different label called Parcel One, because many people don't realize we have the first assessor's parcel in Napa Valley, 001. So we created a wine label called Parcel One that looks like the old Bonanza TV series when it comes
yeah,
on.
Yeah, that's right.
The label
ready for
burns,
the arrow for it to burn off.
Yeah. So, and we wanted to do something that would be affordable for a lot of people who wanted white wine and didn't want to pay, you know, a huge amount of money. So the thought was that if we found the right Sonoma vineyards that were affordable grapes from the mountains and make a early delivery Chardonnay with not overwhelming fruit, not overwhelming oak, but just a very refreshing wine, that would be the concept that we could sell for around $40.
Yeah.
And so that's what we've tried to do. We specifically, everything we do is French oak, by the way, Matt, but even the Chardonnay, but we cut back on the amount of new barrels on this to really emphasize a more fresh, forward Chardonnay product. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't make a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, there's very few markets where this wine is even sold.
Oh, yeah?
There's only, and Toronto is one.
Mm-hmm. Is it 2000, you said fast, what, is it 2018?
16.
Okay, sorry. We wanted to get it off to the market quick. I need better glasses. I'm like, wait a minute, it can't be 18.
Yeah.
That's impossible.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So Parcel One, 2016.
Yeah.
Sonoma County Chardonnay.
Right. From two little vineyards.
Mm-hmm.
Right in the foothills in the Sonoma Mountain area. So it shows, as you can see, there's a little bit of vanilla from the oak, a little bit of cinnamon.
Mm-hmm. A little smoky. A little spice.
Some nice, a little bit of apple, you know, kind of a light varietal.
Mm-hmm.
But stylistically, it's I like my acid.
Yeah.
The acid is there.
Yep, absolutely.
It's still round. It's still a round finish.
Mm-hmm. Yep, no, it's, I think the word you used a couple times was fresh, mm-hmm. which I guess is what you're trying for all your wines. And yeah, there's you know, a little more freshness than often what you will find in California Chardonnay. Now, I will say my wine guilty pleasure, I don't mind slightly overly oaked Chardonnay.
Right.
I think it's, you know, as a kid, I loved candy. So that's always my guilty pleasure. But of course, my favorite Chardonnay, like I think most everyone else, is good and balanced, which this is. And yeah, I mean, Chardonnay is just always such a wonderful, when done well, just such a wonderful wine to drink. Mm. So bouncing back and forth.
Yeah.
How skeptical are you of wine critics, critic scores, wine competitions?
You're reading my mind.
I know. I did my research.
I'm just kind of tired with this whole score game.
Yeah.
We normally do not send our wines out for numerical scores.
Yeah.
I would love it if every time we sat with a wine critic or a restaurateur or a somm, we just talked about the wine and described the wine, and they decide whether they like the wine or they just don't care for it or whatever. The whole score thing is just out of control. I mean, there's a couple major publications now that from a winemaker perspective, this is just a winemaker's perspective, some guys will want to commit suicide if they don't have a 93 or 94 point wine, because the new average is more than 90. That's
ridiculous. It was always the benchmark was, wow, could you hit 90?
Yeah.
So then what does 87 mean?
87 is not very good.
Yeah.
82 means you better change careers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Is it how much of this just, there's so much insecurity in the wine world, and I mean from the consumers, because, and I get it, because wine can be intimidating, and so then you see the high score and you flock to it, much the same way in the movie Sideways. Paul Giamatti delivers one line about Merlot. Merlot sales tank, even though the bottle of wine he's drinking at the end, this Cheval Blanc, has got 40% Merlot in it.
Yeah.
You know, how much of it is just these people are desperate for the high scores because the wine buyer feels more comfortable knowing, I might not know much about wine, but there's a 91 on this, so it must be good.
That's right. That's right. It's a fear thing, and it's an education thing. Because most consumers who are coming up in the world, they feel comfortable talking to their friends.
Yeah.
They feel intimidated by maybe the technical aspects of wine or the, you know, the flowery language that comes with descriptions.
Slightly bruised over ripe peach.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So what is that? So when someone says,
yeah,
this is my favorite one, this goes back to the 70s.
Okay.
I love this. This is my favorite. So,
all right.
What does the word fat mean? So this word as a descriptor came out in the 70s and was the last senior year at Davis, my last class. It was a wine tasting class. And someone in the class said, it's fat. And then the professor berated him.
Mm-hmm.
And said, how do you describe fat? Have you seen this wine? Is it the bottle, you know, does it have a midriff bulge in the glass bottle? So we need to be a little bit careful, you know, sometimes the way we describe wines. Is the wine lonely? Well, lonely?
Lonely?
What does that taste like?
Not in my house. Wine's rarely lonely in my house.
So to answer your question, yeah, I'm a little bit skeptical and a little bit peeved at times.
Yeah.
And thank God we're a small enough winery and we're so focused that, you know, we don't live and die by the scores, because some people, you know, you better be prepared to get a high score once, sell your wine out, and then guess what? The next vintage you get a low score.
Yeah.
And you have no other plan. You know, no one's tasted your wine. You have no marketing plan. So it's important to understand what you're dealing with on the points.
Yeah, it always feels ridiculous. All right. Here's something I've always wanted to ask. America, and like a lot of nations, there's a nationalistic pride. And I'm not even against it. I know people get worried about it. But when done right, it's a lovely thing. We have it here in Canada. But the one thing I always find interesting, especially for Pinot producers, every American Pinot producer says the same thing. Well, our wine is made the Burgundian style, and they always, always, always say it. Then you taste it, and even when it's good, it's like, this is good Sonoma Pinot. And yes, right. I get, you know, it's not as extracted as maybe the big factory one, but it always amazes me that every winemaker, on one level, they're proud to be American, but when it comes to their wine, and specifically like Pinot or sometimes Chardonnay, it's like, no, we're Burgundian. We're not American. I always find that sort of psychology fascinating.
Yeah. Well, it's they're seeking the highest standard, I guess. So, you know, hats off to the French winemakers making Pinot Noir.
Yep.
So, you know, that's the standard. Much like Champagne, how many California winemakers get it wrong and pour their wine, which is sparkling wine, and call it Champagne? And we all know in the trade, we're serious professionals, we know it's not Champagne. There is a difference.
Yeah.
There is a difference between great Burgundies and California Pinot Noirs.
Yeah, of course.
So what I like to say when people, because we make a small amount of Pinot Noir, we're not tasting it today.
But I have some of it at home.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so people ask me to describe this wine. I say, well, you know, it's halfway between the Sonoma Coast and Willamette Valley.
Yeah.
And that's my cop-out in a way, because I say, well, it's probably somewhere in there, but has elements of both. But it's not Burgundy, it's not Willamette, and it's not Sonoma Coast.
Yeah, it's Tom Eddy. I always want to tell these winemakers, you know, you make a good product, Sonoma. There's lots of good soil, and you can make wonderful wines here. Just call it your wine. You can say we model ourselves after Burgundy in terms of yield and you know, just density of planting. There's all these ways, but same point, just, you know, don't be afraid to say, yeah, this is American Pinot and we should be proud of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to ask you the next question. Okay. I'm going to pour the first red, and this is your Elodian.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, why don't you explain to people just a little bit, because, well, I have all your wines, a little bit about the Elodian wine that we're going to be tasting.
Well, Elodian is, by the way, Elodian is a sea turtle,
mm-hmm.
and there's quite a story. I don't know if we have time to go through that, but just suffice to say that it was a label that we created for my wife,
yep.
whose family had a history in the wine business, who sailed from Nova Scotia, and there was this... There was an engagement with an Elodian sea turtle, which saved the family and got my wine. Got my wife eventually in the wine business. So that's how we met.
Yeah.
So that was the commitment, and we started the Elodian Cab in the year 2000. It was a big harvest, pretty good wines,
mm-hmm.
a lot of pressure on me. That was the first year after 10 years that I. Made two wines.
Because
mm-hmm. prior to that, we only made the Tom Eddy Napa Cab.
Yeah.
The Elodian was an opportunity as our brand developed and grew to create a second tier cab with the idea it would be the same Tom Eddy winemaking standards with a couple exceptions. Number one, we weren't going to age it for 3 years in French oak.
Yeah.
Only 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That way we could afford to sell it at a lower price and get it out more quickly without really compromising quality. We just wanted to have less time in the barrel. And then the second thing is I always wanted the ability to do some blending if necessary.
Right.
And so although in most years it's Cabernet on the label, remember that it doesn't have to be 100%.
85%, 15% yeah. could be other varietals.
So if we had a project going on, or we had some press wine, or we had a Malbec vineyard that we were experimenting with and so forth, I was always had the ability to flex a little bit and try some different blends.
Okay.
So that's what makes the Elodian, whereas the Tom Eddy is the same
strict.
Consistent style with 100% cab. The Elodian oftentimes from one vintage to the next might change more subtly because of a little bit of Pinot Noir mixed in with it, or a little bit of Merlot or Malbec.
Pinot Noir mixed in. That's something I have.
Don't tell everybody.
Okay. No. You know, because sometimes some of the bad Pinot I drink feels like, ooh, there's about 40% Syrah in here and
yeah.
only 60%.
I understand.
All right. So as I pour a question, I think, because I always try to think of questions that will really get you going. And I saw this stat, and actually it's from you. 14 wineries in Napa, 1963, 758 wineries today. And that quote might be a couple years old, so it might be over 800. What percentage of, for you, of Napa wineries over the past, say, 10 to 15 years are about ego as much as they are about the desire to make a wine that expresses the land?
Oh, my God. I have to say, at least in Napa Valley, which is, you know, kind of the Beverly Hills of California wine. Unfortunately, I have to say, unfortunately, there's too much ego involved today and not enough commitment to handcrafted, you know, farming practices, handcrafted winemaking, family winemaking. It's all about branding. It's all about egos, it's all about money, and it's really, really unfortunate. Sometimes my wife and I sit on our rocker on the deck and say, with a sipping wine, and say, you know, we feel like it's not that we're older, it's just we feel like we're a dying breed.
Yeah.
That
you're mom and pop next to Kmart.
We're mom and pop. Yeah, that's right. And it's really unfortunate. We stick to our principles. We try and do handcrafted wines that are really high quality. And it's hard. And I understand the whole ego thing. I understand people, they made their money in another industry.
Yep.
And they've always loved wine, and mm-hmm. they want to have their name on the label. And damn it, whatever it takes financially, they're going to get that.
Yeah.
You know, we feel like this is all we've done in our whole lives, and we're so committed to it. And by the way, it's tough to compete, you know, because as you said, there was 14 wineries in Napa Valley in the 60s. Now there's over 800. That's a lot of shelf space.
So shelf space, it also increases the price of land, or also just renting equipment or labor and just everything else. You know, and prices are always just going to go up just by natural, you know, the laws of economics and inflation. But this gets artificially inflated. It's like I always tell everyone, if you want to get a Cabernet Sauvignon and you want a Napa Cab and you're paying $16 for it, there's an excellent chance that there's been 100 shortcuts to make that wine, a lot of chemicals and sugar. And it's because they have no choice because of the real estate and everything is so expensive that to say it's Napa Cabernet, get it under 20, that's hard.
It's very hard, very difficult. I'll give you a great example of that. One of the best vintages in Napa Valley for Cab was the 1997. Mm-hmm. You've had those wines, you know how great they were. I was buying some fantastic Cabernet in those days, farming some fantastic Cab. And the average price for those grapes in 1997, $2,000 a ton.
Yep.
Today, the same vineyards.
Same vineyards
between $12,000 and $14,000 a ton. So what that means is that in order to make the same margin as a winemaker, you've now got to take a bottle of wine you were selling for $30 and sell it for $200.
Yeah.
It's obscene.
Yeah. It's true.
Very challenging.
Yeah.
It's very challenging.
So what do we...
This is the loading cab.
Mm-hmm.
And we bottled the 14. This is the 14. This is the potpourri wine. I mentioned that we use some other varieties.
Yep.
This is one of the few vintages of loading, which is about 80% cab.
Mm-hmm.
But for fun, we used a new experimental vineyard of Malbec up on Diamond Mountain.
Yep.
We had a little bit of that Pinot Noir, a barrel or so of that, and and maybe two or three other new Cabernet vineyards. So it's a really easy to drink, kind of nice, high quality entry Napa Cab. This wine sells for about $60 US.
Mm-hmm. Very smooth. That's the first thing that comes through. Like dark raspberry. Mm. You get a little bit, the plum and the chocolate is there, especially near the finish. I got to remember to keep the mic near my face because as I'm talking, I know the mic is going this way. I'm being a bad host. And when you, as always, what would you say?
Well, there was a little bit of. I cheated, of course, because I knew what's in the blend. But there was just a kiss of that Malbec varietal that's there. Even though it's only about 8%, it came through for me. I don't expect everybody to get it, but it's a nice complexity to go with the classic, more classic blackberry qualities that you get from, or cassis that you get from Cabernet. So it's a wine that we do quite well with in the restaurants because by the glass.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And if you can get, a high end, you're going to be charging early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
But for early to mid 20s for a well-made Napa Cab, everyone wins. The restaurant makes their money. And if you're out, that's hard to get. So as the consumer, that's absolutely a good deal on both ends.
Well, and the other thing is I want to point this out, that is people ask me this question all the time. Well, what do you do with the barrels? You buy these brand new $1,200 French oak barrels for your Tomedy Napa Cab. Then what? Do you use them again? Do you sell them? What do you do? And that's the perfect venue for the Elodian.
Yeah.
So once the Tomedy Cab comes out of the new French oak, the loading goes in. It still has a couple years of nice extract to pull. Not as in-depth as the Tom Eddy Napa Cab, but still works out perfect for the loading.
And also, should be said, this wine, we can not use the word extract, not extracted. It's not... It's not too big, and I think some people, they worry about their calves that it just, they get overwhelmed, and it's not overwhelming. It's not supposed to be overwhelming, and which is different from there's a lot of depth, there's a lot going on, but you're not getting overwhelmed with it. It's like, you know, a thoughtful movie that doesn't have explosions. You know,
There you go. I love that analogy.
I'll go with that one. So we've gone already 40 minutes, and wow. You know what we haven't talked about? Two things. We're going to talk about your final wine. We haven't talked about the fires.
Oh, right.
80%, 2017, you lost about 80% of your grapes.
Yes.
As you said, it represented about $2.5 million loss. Your house was spared, but your assistant winemaker and his wife, not so lucky, their entire house was burned down in Santa Rosa. I was wondering if you could just take us there. What was that like at its worst moments?
Worst moments. We were ground zero. The fire started 1 mile away at 9:25 with 80 mile an hour winds. We were asleep and we had a house guest. So 25 minutes later, she is on her computer. The window, the room brightens up. She's thinking, did I leave the light on?
You know? Really?
She stands up and sees flames in the window down the road. Wakes me up, of course, in a panic. This is how fast it moved, Matt. We didn't, we immediately called CAL FIRE, 911.
Yeah.
They said, there is no fire. What are you talking about? The dispatcher said, there's no fire in your area. We hung up. We called the neighbor, who's Storybook Winery, and they yelled at me on the phone. They said, where are you? Get out, is what they said. We saw the flames coming up. We figured we had 5 minutes, if that.
Really?
And even though you always think that you're prepared, you're never prepared, you know, emotionally, mentally. I was going nuts, and I just we grabbed the cat, we grabbed a bag of food, I had my safety gear and chainsaw, shovels, and some water. That was it, and we drove out the back way, and we hunkered down along with 100 neighbors in cars out in the middle of the field because the wind was knocking down the trees and power poles. Mm-hmm. And we sat and watched the fire race to across the ridge toward Santa Rosa West. And by 2 a.m., there was 9,000 structures destroyed, 6,000 homes, 48 people lost their lives by 2 a.m.
By 2 a.m. And what time were you alerted by your house guest?
At 9:45 p.m. at night. Yeah. Pretty devastating.
Yeah.
So we're recovering. We were locked out basically for 16 days. We couldn't save all the wine. It was outside on the winery crush pad in open tanks. We did save two fantastic lots, beautiful wines that were already in barrel.
Yeah.
So as I tell all my friends, we'll have one great Cabernet out of 217. It's going to be very expensive.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I mean, just it's like anything else, supply and demand.
Yeah.
What's your relationship with that 2017 vintage going to be when it gets released, like 2021, 22?
Well, I'm going to enjoy it.
Yeah.
I might keep a few extra cases back to drink myself.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a crazy story.
It's one of these things that so many people in our area were affected that you can't, in northern Napa, northern Sonoma counties, there are 200,000 people living, and you cannot, it's impossible to meet someone on the street that doesn't have some experience, either direct or indirect, from the fire.
Yeah.
Devastating. Just devastating.
Yeah, I remember talking to Don about it all the time and following the stories and checking your Twitter account and just checking around that entire area. Yeah, and it's it's something that, you know, it happens, but that story and that fire was beyond anything that we had seen before. All right, let's talk about something happier. The final wine that we're going to try.
So this is the Tom Eddy flagship. We call it the flagship because
yeah, you can just tell.
Beginning.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm sorry. No, in the beginning it was essentially the only wine we made.
Yeah.
So, and it still represents about 40% of what we make. It's always been a fun wine to make because I always take select mountain vineyards to put them together. Always 100% Cabernet Sauvignon. And the first question I always get is, well, wait a second, don't you want to blend anything? No, I don't.
Yeah.
Well, is it going to be too tannic? Is it going to be too herbaceous? Say, well, if you process the wine, if you make the wine and handle it in new French oak for 3 years, and you sell off the press wine, like I already mentioned,
yeah,
you can still make a very elegant wine with balance. And that's the whole thing with us, is we want to continue that string.
First on the nose, like just the aromatic intensity of this wine, it just jumps out at you. Like the dark fruit, the dark raspberry, dark strawberry, but I mean red fruit as well.
We like to say black fruits sometimes versus red fruits.
Yeah. And
this has some of both, though, I think, you know.
Oh, absolutely it does.
And if you, here's one of my most favorite things, and it doesn't always, you don't always get it. With French oak, you tend to have more complex aromas than American oak, oftentimes quite spicy. And that's what I really like.
Mm-hmm.
And the flavors and the aromas are always changing. And I just got a kiss of coconut. And I don't get that very often.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one or two barrel coopers that somehow when they toast their barrels, I think I know which ones they are, we get this little coconut character. I love that.
Yeah.
It just comes and it goes away now. But mm-hmm. This is a wine that's going to age.
Yeah, and it's going to, but the great thing is it's going to age, but you can drink this now. A, because how long you've put it away, but also the one thing I didn't know was that you don't use the first press wine that you get, you get rid of that. I mean, this is very smooth, much like the Elodie, and there's more complexity going on, but there is a delicacy. There is a delicacy to this, which that's not an adjective you usually use for California Cabernet Sauvignon.
Right.
You know, that's more, you know, it's more Bordeaux, you know. You think Saint-Emilion or, I mean, I guess that's more Merlot-based, but, you know.
I understand.
You know, you think Saint-Estaf, Saint-Julien, and then that's where you get more. You think Margaux, and this certainly has a higher level of delicacy than what you're going to normally find in California.
Well, you know, I'm glad you said that because oftentimes people pin me to the wall and say, okay, now, Tom, what are your wines most like? Give me some other Napa Valley producers.
Yeah.
And I say, well, actually, they're more like Bordeaux in some ways,
mm-hmm.
like a Margaux, for example. Because
it's a California Margaux.
There you go. I like
that
term.
It's a California. It's still California.
Let's stick with that. California.
You know, because you're still led a little bit more with the fruit than you would be with Margaux, where there'd be a little bit more tertiary. Not that there's not here, but it's California Margaux. I think if I was going to describe it, that's what I would go with.
Yeah. No, I like that. I like that. And, you know, California is now, so we haven't really got into this, but you know how a lot of Napa Valley winemakers in particular now are picking so late that they're losing a lot of that acid. And what they're also losing, they might get a good score from a major publication early on a release, but what they're losing is the ability for ageability, for structure and ageability over time because they picked so late and the acid's been lost and so forth. And this is what one of our main sacrifices is that by producing more of a California Margaux, we're ensuring that we're going to have ageability and collectability.
Oh, yeah.
And that's so important for us.
I've got some of your 08s, 09s. Not many, but I got a couple still kicking back. I opened up one of your wines when I closed my cottage this past year.
Oh.
Yeah. So I try to save it for then. As we ended, and yeah, we went heavy. I told Dawn, and by the way, again, Dawn from Barrel Select, she will be doing this podcast. And I'm talking a little bit louder in case she can hear me, because she's a little more shy. And I'm like, no, I want to talk to you. I want to talk to Barrel Select. So she'll be on it. But I told her, oh, yeah, it'll be 35, 40 minutes. We're at the 50-minute mark, so I'll leave with this question. Do you see a finish line? You've been doing this for 40 years. What's the next 5 years? How do you envision it?
Well, the next 5 years is my preparation for the 5 years after that.
Yeah.
I know that sounds crazy, but one of my goals, one of my dreams has always been to have a wine tasting experience, meet someone new that I liked, that really enjoyed our wines and wines in general. And I always present this challenge to them. And you would be a candidate, Matt. Said, let's say we sit and we drink a 2012 and we talk about its unique qualities and how special it is to you and to me.
Yeah.
I make a promise that you come back and see me in 15 years and remind me of that conversation. We're just going to leave the Madding crowd.
Yeah.
We're going to walk up to the top of the mountain. We're going to sit together, open that bottle of wine from that year, 2012, and enjoy it together 15 years later. So the challenge for me is I've got to live at least 15 or 20 years more.
Yeah.
So we can have these experiences. That's what I live for.
I love it. That is a perfect way to end this. Hey, Tom, thank you so much. Really appreciate you can find Tom Eddy's wines. Just go through Barrel Select. If you're listening in Canada, if you're listening in the States, just Google it, Tom Eddy, and you can find his product. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Matt. It was so much fun to be here with you.
This has been the 8th episode of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can get it on iTunes, Stitcher, and Audio Boom. And as always, everybody, happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.